This is Romantic Circles Audiocast. The audiocast you're listening to is part of a Praxis series volume, Deleuze and Romanticism.
My name is Rob Mitchell, and my paper is entitled The Transcendental, Deleuze, P.B. Shelley, and the Freedom of Immobility. One of the primary goals of this panel is to highlight the utility and importance of Gilles Deleuze's philosophy for scholars of Romanticism. My paper seeks to establish the relevance of Deleuze for Romanticists and Romanticism by linking Deleuze's philosophy both to one of the central Romantic-era philosophers, Immanuel Kant, and to one of the more philosophical British Romantic poets, Percy Shelley. What I'm going to argue in short is that part of Deleuze's philosophical method, what I'll call, following James Williams, Deleuze's method of transcendental deduction, both connects Deleuze to the Kantianism with which scholars of Romanticism are so familiar, but at the same time digs deeper into tensions that vex Kant's system, a reading of Kant that then helps us to better understand the role of passivity and temporality in Percy Shelley's writings. I've divided this presentation into three parts. I begin with a quick reminder of the central elements of Kant's method of transcendental deduction. I then consider Deleuze's peculiar version of the transcendental deduction, and I conclude with a brief reflection on Shelley's poem, Mont Blanc. Before moving into my first section, though, I wanted to give you a sense of my motivations in writing this paper. The paper has its origins in part in a book project on Romantic-era vitalism, but probably more specifically in a graduate seminar on romantic conceptions of life that I taught this past year. I had students read part of Deleuze's difference repetition for this course, and in one of the sections we considered, Deleuze suggests that our experience of time is the result of three syntheses. There is first what Deleuze calls a sensible synthesis, by which he means the synthesis of past and future into a present that occurs, quote, in the mind which contemplates prior to all memory and reflection, end of quote. There is second the active synthesis of conscious memory. But Deleuze argues that both of these syntheses are dependent upon, quote, organic syntheses, which are like the sensibility of the senses. They refer back to a primary sensibility that we are. We are made of contracted water, earth, light, and air, not merely prior to the recognition or representation of these, but prior to their being sensed. Every organism is a sum of contractions, of retentions, and expectations. End of quote. Now, a particularly bright undergraduate who's taking the course objected to Deleuze's attempt to ground sensible and perceptible syntheses, that is, the first and second synthesis, in an organic synthesis, and the nature of this objection was quite astute. The student argued that whereas Deleuze's claims about the former two syntheses, that is, the perceptible and sensible syntheses and the syntheses of memory, seem like philosophical claims, in the sense that philosophy could adjudicate whether or not Deleuze was right or wrong, the question of an organic synthesis seemed to be operating in a completely different level of analysis, biology or physics rather than philosophy. Or, as he put it in a more Kantian tone, Deleuze was guilty of making an unwarranted movement from transcendental to ontological claims. I think this is an astute observation, but the purpose of this paper, in part, is to map out the itinerary that would justify Deleuze's movement through Kant to something like ontology. So the first part, the Kantian transcendental deduction. I want to begin with a quick reminder of how Kant understands the term transcendental. Kant introduces the concept of the transcendental in the introduction to the Critique of Pure Reason, noting there that he describes as, quote, transcendental, all knowledge which is occupied not so much with objects as with the mode of our knowledge of objects, insofar as this mode of knowledge is to be possible a priori, end of quote. Now, the pronoun our is quite important in the quote that I just read, that is, the transcendental concerns the mode of our knowledge of objects. Kant is interested, as this pronoun suggests, in the a priori modes of knowledge of the particular kinds of beings that we are. And according to Kant, we are a kind of being that is characterized by three active faculties. Now, as Deleuze notes, Kant in fact uses the term faculty in two senses. Sometimes Kant uses the term faculty to refer to relationships between representations and objects. And in these cases, he refers to the three faculties of knowing, desiring, and feeling. So, for example, Kant speaks of the faculty of knowing when he refers to our efforts to make our representations conform to external objects. He speaks of the faculty of desire when he refers to our efforts to produce the objects of our representation, as when, for example, we seek to be the cause of a moral action. And he speaks of the faculty of feeling when he refers to the effect of a representation on the vital force of the subject, That is the capacity of a representation to intensify or diminish the sensed vital force of a subject. According to Kant, our everyday experience involves different and often confused kinds of relationships between the three faculties of knowing, desiring, and feeling. For example, we may claim to have knowledge of an object when in fact we simply desire it, or we may believe we desire an action when in fact the representation of this action simply produces pleasure. Thus, as Deleuze notes, a transcendental analysis of these faculties, that is, the faculties of knowing, desiring, and feeling, means for Kant the task of locating the higher form of each of these faculties. A higher form of a faculty means a form in which the faculty gives itself its own law rather than being directed by other faculties. The higher form of the faculty of knowing, for example, would be that form in which knowing gives itself its own law rather than being directed by the faculties of desiring or feeling. However, Kant also uses the term faculty in a second way, to refer to a source of a representation, rather than the relationship between representations and objects. And in the second instance, he speaks of the three faculties of reason, understanding, and imagination. The faculty of imagination, for example, links intuitions of objects with concepts, the faculty of understanding produces concepts, and the faculty of reason produces ideas, which in Kant's system are concepts that go beyond the possibility of experience. And in fact, he actually speaks of four faculties here, for there's also the faculty of sensibility, by means of which we generate intuitions, what he calls intuitions. However, this faculty is not of special interest to Kant because it is not, for him, active. That is, it does not synthesize. It is simply a faculty of reception. As Deleuze notes for Kant, quote, "Our constitution is such that we have one receptive faculty and three active faculties," end of quote. Now, it's Kant's method of transcendental deduction that allows us to link these two senses of the term faculty. We locate the higher form of the faculties of knowing, desiring, and feeling when we employ a transcendental deduction to determine what Kant calls the relationships of legislation between the faculties understood in the second sense, that is, as sources of representation, in which case we have the three faculties of reason, understanding, and imagination. For Kant, the faculties of reason, understanding, and imagination are all always involved in each of our pursuits and activities, but the question is, which of these faculties directs, that is, which legislates for the others? In the Critique of Pure Reason, transcendental deduction reveals that a higher form of knowledge is possible when the faculty of understanding legislates over, that is, directs the activities of, the faculties of reason and imagination. While in the Critique of Practical Reason, transcendental deduction reveals that a higher form of desire is possible when reason legislates over the faculties of the understanding and imagination. So part two, the Deleuzian transcendental deduction. Now all of what I have said will strike you, I assume, as uncontentious, that is simply an explication of Kant's claims as Kant presented them. What interests Deleuze about the Kantian system, though, are Kant's brief allusions to what Deleuze calls the genetic aspects of Kant's system. That is, those moments in which Kant realizes that he can't simply assume valorized particular legislative relationships between faculties, but instead has to show the conditions of possibility that would allow such relationships to be produced in the first place. And with respect to these genetic moments in Kant, the moments of genesis, Deleuze argues, in short, two points. First, he argues that the condition of possibility for any determinate legislative relationships between faculties is that these faculties are capable of a free and indeterminate, that is, a non-legislative mode of accord or harmony. And second, he argues that such non-legislative modes of accord can only be understood if we understand the terms sensation and ideas, those two terms, sensation and ideas, differently than Kant. Rather than understanding sensation as simple receptivity, as does Kant, we have to understand it as a mode of synthesis. And rather than understanding ideas as non-determinate concepts produced by reason, as does Kant, we have to understand them as tensions, what Deleuze calls problems, that traverse all the faculties and tie these faculties into the world itself. Let me begin with Deleuze's claim about the relationship between legislative and non-legislative modes of relationship between faculties. Deleuze argues that Kant cannot, within the terms of his own system, simply, quote, invoke a harmonious accord of the faculties that characterizes the different legislative relationships of knowledge and morality. Rather, quote, "the critique in general demands a principle of this possibility for an accord of the faculties," end of quote. Deleuze argues that Kant himself locates the condition of possibility for these different forms of harmony between faculties, in a more fundamental capacity for a, quote, free and indeterminate accord between faculties. That is, Deleuze argues, quote, every determinate accord between the faculties presupposes that the faculties are, at a deeper level, capable of a free and indeterminate accord. It is only at the level of this free and indeterminate accord, the sensus communis aestheticus, that we will be able to pose the problem of a ground of the accord. Not surprisingly, Deleuze turns to Kant's Critique of Judgment into its analysis of the so-called reflective judgment, that is, the kind of judgment that Kant describes as characterized by free and indeterminate accord of faculties, in order to locate the ground of the determinate accord that characterizes legislative relationships between faculties that he articulated in both the Critique of Pure Reason and the Critique of Practical Reason. In the third critique, Kant's two primary examples of free and indeterminate accords of faculties are judgments of beauty and sublimity. And Deleuze argues that in both cases, Kant suggests that these accords of faculties are produced as responses to experiences of difference or intensity. In the interest of time, I'll consider just Deleuze's discussion of Kant's account of sublimity. According to Kant, of course, judgments of sublimity are dependent upon an accord between the faculties of reason and imagination, insofar as in judgments of sublimity, the soul must discover that both of these faculties have a supersensible destination. However, as is also well known, the pleasure produced by this accord of the faculties of reason and imagination emerges from an initial dissonance between these two faculties, a dissonance produced by the fact that the faculty of reason demands something of the faculty of imagination, namely, that external objects be gathered together into a whole, which the imagination cannot accomplish in the case of very large or powerful objects. Now, Kant is primarily interested in the result of this accord between reason and imagination. That is, for Kant, quote, this is a quote from Deleuze, the sense of the sublime is engendered within us in such a way that it prepares a higher finality and prepares us ourselves for the advent of the moral law. That's what Kant is interested in about the sublime. What interests Deleuze, however, is not the result of the accord between imagination and reason, but the fact that such an accord is produced. That is, in judgments of sublimity, quote, the imagination-reason accord is not simply assumed, it is genuinely engendered, end of quote. From Deleuze's perspective, what Kant neglected to do, but should have done within the terms of the critical system, was to account for the condition of possibility of such a production of an accord that is free and indeterminate, that is, the production of what Deleuze calls a discordant harmony. Deleuze is interested in this discordant harmony since, he claims, in such moments, quote, each faculty communicates to the other only the violence which confronts it with its own difference and divergence from the other faculties, end of quote. For Deleuze, in other words, judgments of sublimity are useful not because of what they may or may not point the subject toward. For Kant, they point subjects toward the higher finality of the moral law, but rather for what they reveal about the limits of each faculty and the conditions of possibility that allow faculties to relate to one another in the first place. Deleuze's analysis of the conditions of possibility for the discordant accord that is produced in judgments of the sublime produces two important modifications to the Kantian system. First, Deleuze suggests that the Kantian understanding of sensation, of sensibility, must be modified. Where Kant understands sensation as a simple receptivity, Deleuze argues that Kant's discussion of the sublime suggests that, in fact, the faculty of imagination could only carry out its tasks, which are, I'll just call quickly, apprehension, reproduction, recognition, if there were a prior, non-conceptual, but also non-imaginative mode of synthesis proper to sensation itself. Deleuze suggests that we call this mode of synthesis proper to sensation rhythm, and it is this rhythm that connects sensation to the world, though again, not through concepts of the understanding or through the specific synthetic activities of the faculty of imagination. Rather, Deleuze claims, quote, the being of sensation is the compound of non-human forces of the cosmos, end of quotes. Deleuze suggests that it is only by establishing the mode of synthesis proper to sensation that we take the true measure of the understanding of transcendental philosophy. That is, quote, empiricism truly becomes transcendental, and aesthetics and apodictic discipline, only when we apprehend directly in the sensible that which can only be sensed, the very being of the sensible, difference, potential difference, and difference in intensity as the reason behind qualitative diversity. End of quotes. Yet Deleuze suggests we still have to go further and ask, quote, what forces sensibility to sense? Here's the second departure from Kantian terminology, for Deleuze suggests that we use the term idea to refer not, as did Kant, to the non-determinable concepts of the faculty of reason, but rather to what he calls the problems that tie living beings into their environment, problems that also serve to link the different faculties of the human subject to one another. Thus, writes Deleuze, quote, it will be necessary to reserve the name of ideas not for pure cogitanda, but rather for those instances which go from sensibility to thought and from thought to sensibility, capable of engendering in each case, according to their own order, the limit or transcendent object of each faculty. End of quotes. It's my third and final part. I'd like to conclude by focusing on at least one way in which Deleuze's reading of Kant can help us to think about a romantic era poet, namely Shelley, Percy Shelley. And I do want to stress that this is not an influence argument. That is, I'm not arguing that Shelley read Kant in the same way that Deleuze read Kant, especially since Shelley's knowledge of Kant was relatively minimal. My point is rather that Deleuze's engagement with Kant provides us with a set of conceptual tools that allow us to make sense of some otherwise confusing aspect of Shelley's poetry and philosophy. And I have time to skim through only one example, Shelley's poem Mont Blanc, but I hope this gives you a sense of what a Deleuzian reading such a poem might look like. I picked Mont Blanc, of course, because it's often been read as an exemplification of an essentially Kantian understanding of the sublime. This is the explicit claim of, for example, Christoph Boda, but there are also many canonical readings of the poem that, though they do not mention Kant, nevertheless develop interpretations that rely on the structure of Kant's sublime, in the sense that they read the poem within the paradigm of what we might call threat to consciousness and its resolution. That is, most critics seem to agree that the poem is or represents an attempt to confront and resolve a threat to consciousness. The threat itself is indexed by the frozen floods and beaming ice of Mont Blanc, phenomena that are, like Kant's examples of the sublime, either too powerful, extensive, or alien for the imagination to encompass. And for many critics, the poem attempts, whether successfully or not, depends on the critic, to resolve this threat to the imagination by, first, discovering in consciousness a capacity of becoming equal to this threat, and second, by coordinating a moral, or at least political, interest with this capacity, those notoriously obscure large codes of fraud and woe that the poem's narrator claims will be repealed should the mountain's voice be heard. A Deleuzian reading of this poem would not so much contest these readings, or this kind of reading, as point to a different aspect of the poem, focusing our attention not on the possible resolutions of the threat the poem announces, but rather on the ways in which such threats allow us to understand the faculty of sensation. Shelley's poem focuses our attention on sensation by using the mountain to reduce his narrator to a state of passivity, what Shelley calls a trance sublime and strange, wherein the singularity of the faculty of sensation can be best revealed. It is from this perspective, the perspective of the trance, the perspective of suspended animation, that the narrator is able to perceive the differentials that connect living beings within an embodied external world. Because this is a differential proper to the faculty of sensation, it can only be sensed, not conceptualized. And so at the level of concepts with which the poem necessarily deals, it manifests itself in a term like torpor. For example, that torpor of the year when feeble dreams visit the hidden buds, or dreamless sleep holds every future leaf and flower. This differential proper to sensation is also manifested by means of other nouns and adjectives that highlight tension and potential energy. And Shelley uses representations of ice, of glaciers and ice gulfs, to link adjectives of suspension, such as stillness and serenity, with verbs of intensity, such as revolving, subsiding, and swelling. It's these verbs of intensity, what Shelley calls in line 33, ceaseless motion, that ensure that the torpor of the year is not so much an accurate conceptual description as a translation into concepts of what is singular in sensation itself. Yet what makes this a poem, rather than simply a poetic restatement of Deleuze's philosophy, is that in its very presentation, as verse, it is designed to isolate, in listeners, the singularity of sensation, and it accomplishes this through its peculiar rhyme scheme. While Mont Blanc is sometimes understood as an example of blank verse, William Keach's classic study, Shelley's Style, revealed the complicated rhythmic structure of Mont Blanc. As Keach notes, of the, quote, of the 144 lines in Mont Blanc, only three end in words which have no rhyme elsewhere in the poem, end of quote. And because Shelley's poem employs irregular forms of rhyming, imperfect rhymes such as the rhyme of down with throne in lines 16 and 17, internal rhymes such as the rhyme of glare and there in lines 131 and 132, and homonymic rhyme, such as the extended rhyme of throne with overthrown between lines 17 and 113, the poem nevertheless feels like it is somehow between rhyming and blank verse. As Keats correctly notes, the irregular rhythmic structure of the poem is related to its thematic content, but Keats himself interprets this relationship by means of the familiar paradigm of threat and resolution. Keats suggests that rhyme in Mont Blanc is sufficiently irregular to help, quote, to help evoke, quote, the untamable wildness Shelley spoke of. Yet, Keats continues, rhyme is also there as one of the resources with which the poet verbally counters, as well as encounters, an experience of threatening power and sublimity. End of quote. Keats, in other words, interprets the irregularity of the rhyme as mimicking for the reader the threat of untamable wildness, while the fact that there nevertheless is rhyme helps counter that threat. In keeping with my interpretation of the poem's content above, I would slightly shift Keats's point and argue instead that instead of producing and resolving a threat, the irregular rhythm of the poem instead functions for the reader as an intensive series, that is, an oscillating movement between the torpor of repetitive rhyme and the leap beyond rhyme, and as such functions as yet another means, that is, a means in addition to the representational content of the poem, that allows the poem's auditor to isolate the singularity of sensation.